Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Due to the themes of this podcast, listener discretion is advised. Maybe you're imagining things. Or maybe that red car has been following you for the last 5 blocks. Lock your doors. Close the blinds. Change your passwords. This is Secrets and Spies. Secrets and Spies is a podcast that dives into the world of espionage, terrorism, geopolitics, and intrigue. This podcast is produced and hosted by Chris Carr.
On today's podcast, I'm joined by Rolf Moat Larsen. Rolf is a senior fellow at the Belfer Center at the Harvard Kennedy School. He was the director of intelligence and counterintelligence for 3 years at the U.S. Department of Energy, and prior to that, he served for 23 years in the CIA. On this episode, we discuss future intelligence threats with a particular focus on climate change and its implications for national security. If you're enjoying this podcast, you can support it in a few ways. First of all, please do leave a review on your podcast app. All reviews help us gain more listeners as it raises the awareness of the podcast. I don't know if you know, but all podcast apps are algorithm-based, and the more interaction the show gets, the more listeners it attracts. You can also become a friend of the podcast through Patreon. For £3 a month, you can become a Patreon subscriber and directly support the show. You'll get a free copy of my film, The Dry Cleaner. Also, you can join us on Twitter. You can directly interact with me by going to @secretsandspies. And lastly, you can watch my short spy film, The Dry Cleaner, which was my first attempt at original spy fiction. It's now available on Amazon Prime and Apple TV. It comes in, I think, around about $2.99. Without further ado, let's get going. I really enjoyed this episode. I think Rolf is a fantastic speaker. I think he's a fascinating guest, and I found it really interesting. So I hope you do too, and I hope you enjoy this one.
The opinions expressed by guests on Secrets and Spies do not necessarily represent those of the producers and sponsors of this podcast.
Rolf, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast today.
Thank you.
Please, could you just tell us a little bit about your background and experience?
Yeah, I'm a career government servant. Age 17, went to West Point after I graduated, served 6 years in the military as an Army captain, then joined CIA.
Yeah.
Spent 25 years in the agency, and my last 3 years in the Department of Energy as the head of intelligence and counterintelligence for DOE in the U.S.
Fantastic. And am I right in believing you were made persona non grata in Russia? Is that right?
Yeah, that was an unfortunate consequence of work. Nothing I did personally, but in 1996 for alleged espionage activity against Russian intelligence officers.
Yeah. Okay, cool. And when discussing U.S. intelligence gathering, we typically look at the CIA and other military intelligence services, yet other government branches also have their own intelligence gathering capabilities with different priorities. Now, you've worked both at the CIA and the Department of Energy. Can you talk to us a little bit about your time at the Department of Energy and why there are so many intelligence gathering services in the U.S. government?
Yeah, the way I like to describe it is that given an $80 billion budget and 17 different intelligence entities for most countries in the world, they would look at that and sort of shake their head. So I do have a little bit of that reaction. I think perhaps we should pare it down a bit. But the reason we have so many is I liken it to playing, whether it's soccer or American football or something. Mm. There are different positions. Each agency or entity represents different capabilities. So to contrast CIA and Department of Energy, which are two of those 17, CIA is the go-to human spying or organization. Now, of course, today they do things like computer operations and things, but it's the essence of CIA's unique value added is its ability to recruit and handle spies and occasionally do covert action, which is executive action that the president authorizes personally. Usually it's something like drone strikes or interrogation or something like that. Whereas Department of Energy I hesitate to use the word niche. They don't like that, but it stands to reason. It's a science based intelligence service. So things that involve science and technology, surprise, nuclear weapons, biological weapons, increasingly energy and climate related global security questions, because Department of Energy has some of the world's fastest supercomputers and phenomenal analytic capability, particularly at a very high scientific level. So I used to make, I've done nuclear related threats my entire life, and CIA is very good at that. But you can't really say they're better than the people who actually build bombs, design and build bombs. So the analysts at Department of Energy offer that unique, different perspective of the people who actually have hands on. So that's a good way to look at it. And then we have things like the FBI, of course, which is both counterintelligence and law enforcement. We have National Security Agency, which does signals intelligence, and various others, for example, Drug Enforcement Agency. So most of those agencies and entities have, I call them entities because they're not all agencies, obviously. Ours was not in Department of Energy. But they all kind of have a unique role. Yeah. Even the State Department has the Intelligence and Research Bureau, which does more policy-based intelligence analysis. So, and I have great respect for all of them, even though, as I said, perhaps we've gotten a little bloated over the decades.
But each one has its own unique thing. So that's good to know that. Thank you. You've mentioned that intelligence today is sitting in one of the most important ages of its own history, possibly since World War II. And you've also said that the role of intelligence services needs to be re-examined. Can you talk to us a little bit about all this?
Yes, the reason I make that fairly dramatic statement, and I'm not really prone to making them, but I think historically we are there because of the where the world is, not because of any particular perspective I offer. But if you look at it historically, the reason why CIA was created was to follow its predecessor entity in the United States called the Office of Strategic Services during World War II, which essentially provided intelligence to the United States during the war against fascism. So after the war, it was no longer fascism in a sense. It was communism and it was totalitarianism. It was the superpower rivalry, and we needed a different agency. And so CIA was created specifically with all the conditions in mind that existed in after World War II. So if you look now, you move fast forward from, say, the mid-40s till 75 years later, we're at another, for the first time, I think, you could probably argue another phase was when the Soviet Union collapsed. But I think, the world hadn't yet metastasized the way it has now, after, at least we weren't aware of it after the collapse of the Soviet Union. So we've kind of been muddling through the last, say, 30 years. Now we're at the phase where I think the new world condition has sort of become clear. You have no longer the superpower paradigm. There's no longer really the same sort of ideological basis for struggle that defines how intelligence agencies should define their mission and work. And most importantly, we've had two major developments that really 9/11 showcase, which is, I call it the rise, well, actually my mentor at Harvard, Graham Allison, the first dean at Harvard, coined the phrase, and I've stolen it. He's aware of that, and I think supportive, called the rise of the super-enabled individual. So we're no longer competing with states and superpower, but then there were rogue states. And now there are groups that emulate states and want to have the power of states. And on top of that, the most important overlay, even on individuals, is this idea of Mother Nature, or threats that are caused by other, human beings for sure, but have global stability consequences like climate change, infectious diseases, regional conflicts that are caused by mass refugees and things like that, that we never really had to deal with in the more orderly world, in a sense, of the Cold War and its aftermath.
Mm. Forgive me for this, but when you mention the hyper-enabled individual, kind of makes me think about Ian Fleming and how his work that used to feel a bit out there is starting to feel more realistic, or maybe prophetic.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The idea of what was his name?
Oh, Blofeld or someone like that. Yeah.
yeah. Yes, exactly. That world is not looking so so strange to us anymore. And very interesting. I've said this to a few insiders and friends. I said, you know, the idea of a James Bond nowadays doesn't look as ridiculous as it did when I used to enjoy those movies and books, because the idea of being out there and findable, which Bond always was, of course, all the bad guys always found him, usually at the poker table or the roulette wheel.
Yes.
And, but that notion is no longer far-fetched. We're increasingly seeing intelligence services out in the light. You know, there, whether it's congratulating Bill Burns, the new head of CIA, on Twitter, or Yossi Cohen, the head of Mossad, proudly trumpeting the Israeli raid in Tehran, where they stole the Iranian nuclear archives, an incredibly dangerous and secret operation that they pulled off a few years ago. Well, we used to never see intelligence services in the light like they are today. Part of that is because, again, they need to be there. They're not, this is an instinctive thing from the high practitioners, I call them, the people at the edge of the profession who are pushing us forward, understand that we can no longer do what we did in the shadows. And even secrecy, as sacrosanct as we've held that for decades, is no longer the ruling criteria for the impact that our work makes.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you think we're going to, sorry, it's going a little bit off topic. Do you think we might see a kind of rise of intelligence services going more in the kind of Bellingcat direction?
Yes. I mean, one reason we've seen the growth of the private intelligence and not just the Bellingcats, but so many corporations now have significant intelligence capacity, not security, but more the proactive, predictive, getting out in front of risks that they're going to encounter in the course of their business. And they're hiring business professionals from all over the world. I had this kind of a romanticized image of future intelligence where, you know, I'm actually, and I've said this even to my Russian colleagues, I'll call them, you know, and friends, that, you know, I see a day in the not so distant future where we're not only going to be spying on one another, but less frequently doing that, and more frequently having to pool our expertise and experience together to deal with common threats. And I think that day is here. We just don't quite appreciate it yet.
Yeah, yeah. What are the future concerns that you have from an intelligence point of view that the CIA and the US government should be thinking about?
Well, foremost among them, and there's really no question in my mind on this, is climate change. And it's not the science, it's not the policy, or it's supporting policy. I like to start with the thought that if for those who are skeptical that intelligence has a role to play in something like this, I say, well, does intelligence have a role to give the president, as it's been its fundamental purpose, the president a decision advantage in making better policy and being more prepared to deal with unanticipated problems? We used to call that in the old Soviet days, foresight and early warning of whether it was a nuclear attack or an incident that might occur that will exacerbate U.S.-Russian relations. Well, today, that's being created by nature, and we need to be poised to deal with things like states that fail because of water wars, because of conflicts arising from inability to feed their people, because of waves of refugees that occur because of the warming planet or cooling planet, from natural events that begin to destabilize the world in various ways. And if there's a unique capability within intelligence, I mean, give it to all the existing entities that may be better positioned to provide that support to policymakers around the world, not just in the US, but internationally and elsewhere. But if not, then intelligence does have some unique capabilities. We have liaison partnerships globally that we've been honing since World War II through trust and experience and interaction, and use those relationships for this purpose to combine, find ways to do things multilaterally. That's another challenge that we've always been trying to do ourselves or bilaterally with other countries. Now we need to find ways to share the burden, to share our understanding of the risks, to multilaterally cooperate, even if that's in parallel, as opposed to being sitting around. I'm still a big skeptic of taking 20 countries and putting them all around a table and calling that cooperation. I think that's the problem with multilateralism. That's not the right paradigm for pursuing it. But that's now I'm getting in the weeds. But the essence of my answer to your question is climate change is my first. The other one, which relates in a way, is how we deal with pandemics and infectious disease, being able to discern what's a man-caused or human-caused outbreak versus a natural outbreak, be able to understand the epidemiology of the diseases better as they evolve through changes in temperature and conditions in countries to understand where the next outbreaks are coming. Because the response to something, even like you might say, well, that's the CDC in the United States or elsewhere, they need to worry about. Yeah, they need to worry about that, the science of it. But we in intelligence need to worry about, how do we respond to it? How do we get on top of it if it occurs? How do we get on the next Ebola crisis in terms of the actions that now take the form of threatening our security through international air travel or things that happen at borders or people coming into countries or identifying where the outbreaks are occurring? Part of that is an intelligence and security function. And the final one I'll mention is WMD. I mean, weapons of mass destruction. Clearly, we've crossed a threshold where we need to worry about nuclear and biological terrorism. That's no longer just what we used to say after 9/11. We used to warn everybody. This isn't just an Islamist problem, an extremist terrorist in the Islamic world. This is now something we need to worry about coming from the far right. Mm. In the U.S., for example, from militia groups that now seek these weapons to give them an edge when they want to take over the capital the next time. Even from the far left. I grew up in Germany, so to speak, with the Baader-Meinhof gang, the Red Army faction. In fact, Baader and Meinhof hanged themselves in a German prison when I was living in Germany in the 70s. Echo far left movement today that's peaceful could potentially become radicalized to the point they become terrorists of the future. Again, I'm not accusing or asserting that this is going to happen, but that's intelligence work in a nutshell, is thinking about these kinds of problems and anticipating where we're going to see the next threats.
Yeah. One question on the WMD topic. Since the Iraq war, there's quite a few people in the public who are quite skeptical about claims of WMD. What would you sort of say to people who have any suspicions and beliefs that it's all made up by sort of George Bush or something?
Well, I never dismiss it, because I dealt with it and I had to deal with it on a recurring basis after 9/11. And to this day, I accept that skepticism as being legitimate. My response to it is that, first, this isn't going to assuage everybody, of course, when I say this, but I would say everything I stand for personally and my professionalism and everything I've worked on, that it was not politicized. And I'm trying to say, tell that story in terms of much more specificity, you know, how President Bush, Dick Cheney, and all of whom I've interacted with extensively on this, actually dealt with the problem of WMD, to show that, one can say whatever one wants to say about the decision to invade Iraq, for example. I myself have characterized that as a intelligence failure, and that CIA cannot avoid that judgment for having gotten that wrong. We didn't get the WMD wrong. We have the stories, we have the evidence, we have the facts, we know what we pursued. We never hyped the threat. I've had foreign services, not just Russians or others, but even the British and the French and Australians and others, question on the basis of what you just said, what I provide, and I've let the facts speak for themselves. We actually thwarted threats. We identified plots. We found people who were involved. Fortunately, I don't think they reached a point of fruition where they obtained, that one bomb, that one nuclear bomb with potential, say, yield-producing device or a large-scale biological weapon, for example. We managed to thwart that. We managed to get in front of that. And I think that's a success story as opposed to being a myth.
Yeah, thank you for that. So I would like to look at sort of climate change. I think that's the main focus of our chat today. And you've been a pioneer in trying to make the US government and the US intelligence community take a more serious look at climate change. This may be a silly question, but what was it that sort of drew you to the importance of climate change, especially when so many people have not taken it so seriously?
I don't think it's a silly question at all. It's, for me, maybe the essential question is, I'm at a phase, both of my professional career, where I've achieved and been fortunate to have been given opportunities that have exceeded my wildest expectations. So I no longer have really any personal ambitions in my profession. I like to think I'm good at what I do. I have a sense of seeing into the future. And so for me, it's about my grandkids. I have 7 grandkids. I don't just mean them, of course. I'm answering the question by saying it's about the future. It's about the future of the world. I have no question in my mind that this is real. I mean, that whole discussion, to the extent it became a ridiculous political issue in the United States, is tragic, actually.
Yeah.
But taking that aside, that if we're talking to sensible people, we'll all understand this is happening right now as we speak. Then the only question is, should we be devoting all these people, capabilities, and resources that I respect so highly, that I've seen work so effectively to safeguard national and global security, do we devote all of that just to terrorists, proliferators, state-to-state rivalries, or we start to actually get in front of something we're going to be dealing with throughout this entire century, which is the slow destabilization of global security because of climate change? And I'm actually at an alarmist, urgent, phase of my messaging now. I started this, quixotic quest maybe 15 years ago when I was in DOE. First came to DOE, I started it almost after visiting the laboratories and seeing the computer modeling and seeing the capabilities we had and saying, oh my goodness, these things need to be applied right now to ensuring our policymakers have a better idea of what's coming down the pike.
And what are your thoughts on the implications of climate change? What do you think we will see? And I suppose maybe also add to that, when do you think we might start seeing those things?
Well, we're certainly seeing it now. I like to say anecdotally that a few years ago, I'm part of a group that Harvard sponsors called the ELBA Group, which is a U.S. and Russian generals, five of them, and we meet every year. We've been doing it during the pandemic via Zoom, but we have intentions to meet in the fall in person again, as continuing a 12-year tradition. Same people from the start, which is really remarkable, all at this sort of general level. We met in Reykjavik 3 years ago, and for the first time, we put climate change on the table as a national security issue that affects both U.S. and Russia. And the Icelanders were wonderful. The foreign minister met us, the experts up there, including the Russian ambassador, who's the permanent member of the council in Iceland, came and gave us presentations. And just to explore what you asked, which is, how does this affecting us now? It's not just a matter of opening up sea lanes across the north. That's and have some economic advantages. What are the rivalistic aspects of it? How are the U.S. and Russia, for example, going to confront one another increasingly in that part of the world, and the other countries that form the countries that share some boundaries of it? Just the North Pole itself is a dramatic illustration of all the issues that are surrounding your question. And I'd say the essence of it could boil down our full day discussion on this to really one thought, can we work through the many things we're going to confront because of the warming of the Arctic as in cooperation or as competitors or both? And a large part of determining what degree of confrontation versus cooperation occurs up there is going to be working through a common understanding of what threats and risks we face there, not just the opportunities.
I've seen you mention in other interviews that there's a possibility we'll see water wars in our lifetime. And I was wondering if you could just sort of talk to us a bit about that and about some of the other dangers on that sort of level.
Yeah, so I want to insert at this point in the discussion something I'm always quick to do, which is, I'm not an expert on climate change and even the science of it. I'm a layperson like everyone listening to this in terms of understanding the nature of the problem, which in intelligence is not really what we need to do. It's like when I need an expert, if I want an expert on nuclear weapons, I'm not the person that tells the president. I go to someone on our national laboratories or in CIA. Yeah. It's the same with climate change. So the first thing I say is I use my experience just to sort of intuit where we're going. I lived in Jordan for 3 years between 2011 and 14. And in those 3 years, I became acutely aware of Jordan's problems because of the fact I hope this is still accurate, the fourth scarcest water country in the world. And it's largely due to, its situation next to Israel. And of course, you've got the inherent both cooperative and confrontational aspects of Arab and Israeli relations in that part of the world. And now you add something as sensitive to people as scarcity of water, which may become acute in the growing years. And if you just live there, you see it with your own eyes. You see the Dead Sea shrinking every year. You see the consequences of irrigation in the Israeli side and the Dust Bowl on the Jordanian side. And you start thinking of Africa. You start thinking of Asia and other parts of the world where these disputes will become determinative. I might add that, you know, the King of Jordan has done a remarkable job of staying power as a ruler, despite having some of the most unique challenges in the world, largely dealing with essential needs of people. I mean, things like, you know, when the oil prices go up of cooking oil, there are demonstrations. So you can pick out countries like that to use as your example. But here's what I would like you to picture, Chris. Picture presidents getting a daily presidential briefing book, which we use in the United States. Every day, the president, vice president, and senior policymakers get this book from the director of national intelligence. And in that book, it's got a significant amount of developments that are occurring in the global security space related to climate-induced risks and problems. So they can read for themselves the trends that are occurring in the world here. So you can begin to anticipate, when does this come to a head? And what does the United States, in our case, need to be prepared to think and do? Is it the aid we need to provide that to perhaps head off a failed state or a state that's in crisis? Is that due now? Should we make that investment now? Do we have another year before we start thinking of it? Should we start dialogues now with other countries to try to solve problems that will become much bigger problems? Now, the context here is always, for intelligence anyway, the context should be always some sort of national security and global stability related, you know, consequence when we get involved.
Definitely. Well, you mentioned failed states, and sadly, traditionally, failed states tend to be the breeding ground of terrorism.
That's correct. So I think I've already made an allusion to, I could see ECHO or far right national terrorism already going after things like new forms of weapons to gain that respect. That's not my world. It's not respect that they think they should be accorded or emulate the power of a state. Can you imagine groups going after nuclear facilities to try to sabotage them to cause environmental catastrophes in some cases? Can you imagine when a failed state crashes, what it's going to do? A new failed state emerges because of some of these problems, say, related to climate change, exacerbating tendencies that already exist. And suddenly we're dealing with places where we're going to see new forms of terrorism, avenues or areas where proliferation make. When I mean proliferation, I mean classic nuclear, biological, chemical weapons, military hardware in itself, type proliferation activity that does destabilize countries and regions.
Yeah. Can you talk to us then about how climate change has been considered by the U.S. intelligence services and U.S. government over the years, and also talk a bit about your efforts to make progress on this issue?
It really doesn't have a very noble history or a proud history. I'll start with that. I don't mean by saying that to discredit or impugn the few individuals I've known over the years that really devoted themselves to this in a very remarkable way. But let's just face facts. There has been no real commitment of significant U.S. intelligence resources or capabilities or leadership interest or priority to climate change ever. Okay, so if you go back into the 1990s during the Clinton-Gore years, I was in Moscow in the early 90s when we actually had a politically directed engagement with Russian intelligence on climate change, mainly for the purpose of exchanging satellite imagery. Okay. At that time, satellite imagery was still, you know, very sensitive and secret. And nowadays you get better stuff commercially than we had access to in intelligence back in those days. So that's been largely overcome by events. But the precedent is important because it was the first time when you have two old enemies, the KGB and the CIA, actually sitting around a table talking about cooperation on climate change, mainly driven by Al Gore, and it was called the Gore-Chernomyrdin initiative. Later at DOE, I created something called the Energy Environmental Security Directorate, with really only one purpose, with a modest amount of money, seed money, I'd call it, just to explore how DOE and intelligence community, because I was dual hatted. I reported directly to the Secretary of Energy and I reported to the Director of National Intelligence as the head of intelligence, just to study what the potential role, if there should be a role for the U.S. intelligence community, and what that role should be. And that was cast in the context of, I believe it's still the only intelligence community assessment on climate change. It was called the National Intelligence Assessment, the NIA, which I went to Congress to defend. It was a community product of all agencies. Unfortunately, for some silly reason, it was made secret, which was a big mistake, I feel. And I went with the head of analysis at the DNI level, Director of National Intelligence, Tom Fingar, who's now at Stanford, great, great man, great analyst. And we defended it, so to speak, and that would be what I would showcase from this period, which would be relentless negative political division over this between the Republicans and Democrats, to the point where it was so divisive between, no big shock there, right? Divisive between the Republicans and Democrats. This was in 2008, by the way. So it's long before our current problems, but it was so disillusioning for me. And I describe in my memoir a scene where I'm with the members of the House and Senate Select Committees on Intelligence trying to justify this very small effort. And I was essentially bribed to do away with it, and I refused to do it. And at that point, my Secretary of Energy stood behind me, and Republican appointee and everything else, but he was a very honorable man, and he believed that we should do this. And I emphasized to him when I was thanking him for his support, and of course he had the president's ear, so it stood while I was there. And I said, you know, what people don't understand is I haven't made any predetermined decisions as to where this is going to go. It is not partisan, but the most important thing is it's our duty to do this as intelligence officers. If we fail to do this, we're derelict in our duties. And that's the way I still feel about it. So 12 years later, I still feel we've been derelict in our duties in the U.S. intelligence community, and for that matter, most other, I think, countries around the world, though it's not my job to judge them. But in my own community, I say, you know, we need to stand up and do a short study, a few months, determine exactly what we need to do, what it would take, what the capabilities should, what are the specific mission areas we want to develop, and what would be our specific outcomes to make a contribution, and then present that to our intelligence community leadership and ultimately to the White House, probably someone like John Kerry, who's President Biden's main climate guru in the White House, and present it to them as our contribution to the national security problems of climate change.
Yeah, thank you for that. So why would the intelligence community be best set to help the U.S. government and possibly world governments tackle climate change?
Well, that's a great question. It's actually, whether people ask it or not, I've given this presentation at lots of places, and the most skeptical audience, I gave it to a small group, maybe 20, less than 20 people of international intelligence officers from all over the world, actually. And there's a lot of, and they were the most skeptical of all the audiences. So and the reason for it is they question the premise that there is a unique value added, that let's not distract ourselves from classical, I would call them classical intelligence work to do this. I say, well, first of all, I agree with you. If you can make that case, then I respectfully withdraw, you know, my pleas. But I've looked at that pretty hard, and then we have a long discussion, and I win some over, and I don't win over others. But the essence of the argument is, what is our unique value added? What can we? So I just would briefly list, and then we get long discussions. Our liaison connections, our emphasis on providing information that produces better policy in U.S. government on national security related subjects. There's really no one else that does this other than intelligence in the U.S. community. It's not, again, questioning the science role or providing the science or providing action that's in the health communities or these other areas. It's specifically providing rigorous analysis through the four aspects of intelligence that are the essence of intelligence, which is set a priority, go collect the information. Now, that doesn't mean secret information. Go collect the relevant information to fulfill that priority. Analyze it using customized tradecraft, analytical tradecraft with great rigor, and then finding the right dissemination mechanism. So you could run a conference around breaking those four things down on climate change and analyze and trying to assess in great detail. For just to take the last one, take dissemination. Is this dissemination should find ways, how do you do it globally? Well, we have these things we call stations around the world that's uniquely a CIA. But when I say CIA, I also mean Department of State, because they generally aren't embassies. I mean Department of Defense, because they generally have attachés around the world. I mean other agencies that are part of what we call the country team. So we have the ability to rapidly disseminate in near real time our work, what we're doing. That's unique in the U.S. government. We just don't fully utilize it. So that's on that side. And then, as I said earlier in our conversation, develop the right approaches to sharing burden. So is it multilateral? Is it bilateral? It's going to be a combination of various mechanisms. Again, we have these, you know, we started off the questioning by talking about World War II to today. Well, let's not throw away everything we've built since World War II. The structure, the edifice of this foundation of great intelligence is based on person-to-person contact. It's based on professional tradecraft. It's based on having mortar and brick around the world we can go to do it. But we just don't use those things for this right now. So what I'm the essence of what I'm advocating is an adaptation of all these things to take this seriously and really go after it.
Why has it been hard for the intelligence community to see climate change as a national security threat? Because it seems very clear to you, but it seems a lot of decision makers don't seem to be sort of seeing it that way.
I think first there's a fear of it'll distract us from whether it's Iran, Russia, China, other priorities. My quick response to that is, well, they're not even the same kind of resources and capabilities, so don't worry. along with a little cautionary, maybe, judgment or at least a wake-up call. Haven't we really got enough? I've always liked to say tongue-in-cheek, I'll stress tongue-in-cheek, we have probably more analysts following the Iranian nuclear program than there are people in the nuclear program. So, I mean, at some point you need to perhaps take a look at what you're devoting all your resources. I think the second has been the politics of it have been very difficult because there's support for doing nothing. I mean, I hate to say that. A third has been institutional risk aversion, I call it. This always gets everybody grimacing when I say it to my colleagues, but I'm so proud of us as a community and our accomplishments. But I will say that we're never good when we sit on our laurels, rest on our laurels, or when we fail to be pushed into something because we're afraid we don't know what we're doing or how to do it. We're not real good on imagination and creativity. We have some individuals who are outstanding, but institutionally, we're like every organization, and you can't have an intelligence agency that's excellent, outstanding, if it's not highly imaginative, creative, and really willing to take big risks, which means spectacular failures, misses, and all the rest.
Yeah.
And over the years, organizations just become, as they mature in particular, they just become more risk averse in this fundamental way of not being very imaginative, creative. So a lot of what I try to offer, and I'm not saying I'm the most creative person in the world or imaginative, but I do like to say, you know, picture the future. You know, think a little bit about the next 20, 30, and not just 10 years, five. We think of long-term forecasting. America's maybe one of the worst countries in the world projecting long-term threats. Maybe the worst, because we're such a today society. Everything's social media, speed and timing. And if it's not done today and tomorrow, it's like irrelevant. That's the way we conduct our business. If it's not in our inbox, we pay no attention to it. We don't really do a lot of long-term research and development because all our money is meant to be spent in a year or two cycles. So on this, you got to really get yourself out of that. You got to get yourself out of your inbox, out of your social media pace, base pace. And you got to really think about the world. What is our world going to look like in 50 years? And how do we prepare now for it? How do you prepare for this world, the problems we're going to confront? And then are we just going to experience all that with shock and awe and wonder, strategic surprise every time something big happens we hadn't anticipated? Or are you going to fundamental, at least put it, I used to say with the WMD, I used to get very exasperated by people who said, well, you know, how do you expect us to solve this problem? I said, well, if you can give me the name of three people, I'll be happy. And then he looked on it, because this is hard to do, actually. Who's in charge in the White House? Who's in charge at the highest level of our national security community, meaning our DNI? And who's in charge operationally in the CIA, which still remains our most action-oriented intelligence entity in the U.S. government? If you can give me good names at those three levels, or any name, so the first challenge is generally they can't give you a name because there's nobody in charge. And then if they give you a name and it's not a good name, it doesn't matter to me how many people you say are on it or how much money you're spending. And that's kind of what I think we are in climate change. I'm not presumptuous enough to sit here talking to you, Chris, and say, I've got the answers. I know how we should do this. But I can tell you, if you tell me the right person at those levels who can think through the policy, strategic, and ultimately operational aspects of the problem, then I'll be confident in my grandchildren and other grandchildren around the world having somebody on it. Because right now there's nobody on it.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus.
Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. And it needs to be. I had a question about cultural changes, but I kind of feel like you've answered that. I mean, is there anything you would add as recommendations for kind of cultural changes in the U.S. intelligence services?
Well, there are lots of little, I like to go through this in a more helpful tactical way when I actually talk to people who might be interested in what I think is where I see the, this is easy to do when you've been out of something for a while. I call it like the armchair, being an armchair sports critic, right? You see the people in the field and you see, so it's so easy for you to see how, but it's especially, you know, you're prone to do that if you did something like I did for so many years and now you've been distant from for a while. And frankly, most of my other priorities have moved on from intelligence related subjects. So I feel like it puts me in maybe a position I can be helpful. But with that long, you know, wind up, I'd say the main thing is think about the things in your culture that are impediments to being outstanding, which means you have to constantly question every day your mission. You have to question how you've dedicated your resource. I call it zero basing every day, where you've put your people, your money, your priorities. Are you getting your bang for your buck? Are you doing the most important thing? There's a tendency in bureaucracies to not do many important things because they're too hard. So part of the climate change thing is it's not defined. So people are lazy about defining it or resistant to even looking at it. And then if they do, they're afraid they can't do it or they don't have the capability, because it's rare to see leaders. So it boils down, the best question, answer to your question is we need really strong leadership. Strong leadership meaning with a lot of integrity. Integrity meaning willing to look at truth to power, say truth to power, look, find the imaginative people, creative people, do what it takes to keep them in organizations where they themselves are not very organizationally friendly and organizations are not generally friendly to them. I do a whole series. It's still one of the things that fascinates me the most about intelligence, about what we call groupthink, where you get a group of people, you know, who are pushed towards conformity. The entire system pushes them towards that. Consensus is what we strive for. So even when we produce, a paper on the Iranian nuclear program with 16 or 17 agencies contributing to it, the essence of the effort is to try to get consensus. And we don't always, which is then a good thing, because then people can put meaningful differences down that might define areas that were either weak or wrong. That's the important thing, where we're wrong. But that's a hard process because we're so driven in organizations. So I'd say be very aware of the bureaucratic kind of things that hold you back. Constantly challenge your culture. Get good leaders, good, strong leaders who push you into the future, not try to excel at the present. And those are some of the things I think that are hard to do because they're not things you could put on a McKinsey list of things you need to do and change an organization, because it's almost never reforming the organization. If someone comes to me and says, we're going to do a study of how we set up the organization for this, I'd say, well, that's absolutely not what you need. You need to know what you want to do and what specific outcomes are you going for, and then tailor something in terms of the methodology and structure that fits that.
Yeah. Is there an opportunity for the intelligence services to sort of work with big tech companies or even the private sector to help on this issue?
Yes. So I went to Harvard in 2009. I've been either a director or a senior fellow there for my 12th year. And the single most important lesson learned, and I've had so many of my old friends and colleagues ask me, what have you learned up there, is just how much of our the knowledge we need to solve major issues in national security today are in the private sector or academia, not in the behind the four walls and vaults that we use to operate out of. And that so much of this information is not secret, and that so many of the world's best experts on a given subject are no longer government workers. And so if we don't solve this problem of tapping more effectively into the outside world, and we keep our analysts and our operators behind closed doors and worry more about how we continue to do espionage like we did in the Cold War than we do about solving problems, we're dead. We're going to die a slow death. And we have traditionally, the USA, for example, worked exceptionally well with our private sector. The private sector has made innumerable contributions to U.S. national security, often at great risk to their corporate equities over the years. And some of those have been detailed and many have not. That's usually a function of, frankly, very courageous and patriotic CEOs and others, people in organizations that see themselves as Americans and not just out to make money. So we have to tap into that. And then we need to tap into academia, which intelligence has always had a kind of very schizophrenic attitude towards. On the one hand, you know, multiple personalities. We don't know whether we want to, you know, the worst thing we can do is as I always like to say, is exploit academia for intelligence purposes, because we need to maintain our credibility. So when you go to academics and say, we need your help, the last thing they don't remember is the time when we would try to recruit a professor or a staff person or a student, and which is not something that typically happens, by the way. But it's just something where trust in all these things you're asking me, trust is such an important ingredient.
Definitely. Well, on that topic of trust, there are obviously many established environmental groups such as Greenpeace who've been doing research and campaigning on climate change for a very long time. Do you think there's any potential the intelligence community could work with those kind of groups?
It's funny you ask that, because I do. I've always wanted to have a conversation with Greenpeace specifically when they would do something like post routes of French transportation of nuclear materials across Europe, you know, because they wanted to draw attention to dangerous materials. And I thought, well, you know, I wanted to ask them personally, you know, in my imaginary conversation as CIA, not trying to hide who I am, you know, do you really think it's a good idea to call attention to this so that terrorists hijack it or you know, somebody blows it up and we've got a major, we've got the very thing you're most worried about. And I've had the same imaginary conversation with heads of organized crime groups where I've asked them or said to them, you know, I just want to make something clear. If your group is ever implicated in transporting, getting involved in a smuggling network of nuclear materials, and we track it down, we're going to take apart your group, every person in the group, and you're going to wish you never existed. I think they get that. You know, so I guess the confluence of interest is the question you raised. Where there is a potential confluence of interest in ways we would not have imagined in what I call the old world, isn't it worth trying to create connections and try, at least see? I've done that my whole life. I was in Russia in the crazy 90s, I call them, when we worked together, CIA and say the FSB, the internal service, or the external service, the SVRR, we worked together on occasional basis in remarkable ways. And I remember having a utterly fascinating conversation with Yevgeny Primakov, who at the time was the head of the SVR. One-on-one, we'd meet about once a week. And he proposed this incredibly imaginative, bold joint initiative between our two services. In fact, I was so sort of taken aback in a good way that you know, I enthusiastically wrote this whole thing up to Washington and sent it in and said, this is it. This is, he's come up with, he's not, as most people would know, obviously Primakov was not an intelligence officer career wise. He was a diplomat. He was an emissary often to Iraq and other countries. And he came up with this marvelous idea because he was very creative and bold. And of course, Washington sent me a cable, said, don't ever send us anything like this again.
Oh my goodness. That's a shame. Well, maybe this is a good segue into this. I've got a slightly darker question. I may be wrong, but the world is sort of feeling a little bit less open to international cooperation these days. I mean, we've had in the UK isolationist policies like Brexit. Obviously, in the US, you've had the rise of Trump and isolationism. And we have growing state rivalries between the USA, China, and Russia. Is there a potential that isolationism could get in the way of progress on climate change?
Well, I think that's a very astute observation. It's already happening. So it's not really a potential. It's a question of how we already overcome it. And the number one ingredient is leadership, frankly. I'd like to think we can find that leadership, that sort of forward-leaning visionary. Vision is something I use all the time. On a different but related note, you know, somebody asked me recently what I thought it would take to get U.S.-Russian relations out of this cynical nosedive, particularly after Navalny, which is a horrible, horrible thing. And how do we even address, you know, some forms of cooperation that are in both countries' interest? I said, really, the only way I can think of it, and this applies, I think, to where we are in the world right now, what we need in the biggest, the most macro sense of your question. We need to rediscover, you know, things, leadership, which would mean Biden would, for example, form a vision of a different kind of relationship. I have my own sort of ideas, but I haven't put that together. He would need to do it. He's the only person in the U.S. establishment, along with Putin, who could drive this forward. And it would start with a vision like Reagan had with Gorbachev. That's it. Mm. I mean, they recognized the world was a Reagan and Gorbachev, for whatever else one how assesses that period of, saw the world where it was headed. And tried to position themselves at that crossroads and did. And I think, you know, we have the same questions on China. Where are we right now? Confrontation. Again, this idea of zero sum game, which always comes up in the U.S. China, U.S. Russia context. I say, well, we need maybe a Nixon and Mao moment. We need somebody reshape, have a vision of a different relationship, as fundamental as those historical things are, because I think the world is fundamentally as different. For example, I used to say this to many of my Russian colleagues, and I wasn't meant, I never meant to preach with them. I wanted to have discussions because their views were often added much to what I was thinking. Don't you agree, as a starting point for a discussion, that there's actually more things that unite us in interest, terms of interest, than there are that separate us, whether it's WMD, whether it's terrorism, whether it's arms control, whether it's climate change, and that we have these problems that we can't get around, whether it's Ukraine or Navalny or, you know, but we can't become hostage to cynicism or the problems that divide us. We have to find a way to work both channels. And we have an early test here in the United States with the new administration where Biden's declared vision, as I understand it to this point, is to pursue a two-track approach with all of countries, but particularly those two, where we cooperate where we can and we confront. And so far, all we've seen is really the confrontational track, because, and we're going to fight in that track. Now, the question now is, can we fight bitterly in that track and develop mechanisms and communication channels for better cooperation as well, or whether those are seen as mutually exclusive? And I will say, for the last 12 years, at least in U.S.-Russian relations, we have generally taken the approach that they're mutually exclusive, that we have to choose cooperation or confrontation. That has to stop, or we're not going to get beyond the point you describe, where we can't find a way to address the sort of cynical pathway we're on.
Yeah. I mean, I'm worried about how climate change can be weaponized by a competitor country, and they might just ignore the international side of it and say, well, this is going to benefit us. Is that a risk, do you think?
Yeah.
Could the country get away with that?
Of course. Yeah. Yeah. I would use the example. I won't use his name because I didn't clear it with him, but I was meeting with a very, very eminent scientist who has had decades long contacts with the Russians and Chinese on climate change. So, and he said, the amazing thing is the experts are in almost complete agreement on the nature of the threat and the problem and risks we face. So I said, that's really good news. I said, so I raised the very question you just raised. So are we going to use it for confrontation or cooperation or for competition or cooperation? He said, well, it'll be both. It'll be both. There's no question that, but whether it's individual companies or states pursuing, we're seeing with the vaccines, for example, right? It's definitely a part of what you're describing. But here was his hopeful comment, and I love to seize on hopefulness when I can. He said, however, he said, the problem is emerging into the light so rapidly that it won't be as long as we think it will be now before they realize we're all in deep shit, so to speak, and we better do something right now. And he says, so that will hasten the process of acknowledging the nature of the problem we face will come much faster, he said. And then he used a few examples for both countries. And in particular in China, it's hit China a lot faster already than it's hit, say, the United States. And in Russia, you could see the trade-offs in the Arctic, but how about the Siberian forest fires or, you know, some of the changes to the, we just saw the whole world got to see if they wanted to watch him, Putin in Siberia having a nice week. Mm. I think he genuinely loves that sort of stuff. Well, what's it going to look like there in 50 years?
Yeah.
I think they're worried about it. I think the short-term bias, if you want to call it that, or weakness in policy is to favor the immediate gains of economic and otherwise, but the long term will hit us much faster than long term. It's going to hit us even in the next few years.
Yeah, I've been accused of being cynical by my wife, I just want to ask you, is there any hope for bilateral cooperation? Should we be hopeful that we can find a solution to this problem?
Yes. So, as I like to say, one of the things I like to do the most these days is talk to, even if it's just an open discussion, young people, whether they're Harvard students or young officers in the intelligence or military worlds. And I say, look, when you look at me, I hope you come to, you know, say two conclusions, at least in my approach to things. One is I started out as an idealist. I'm even more idealistic now. So nothing of 30 something years in government is, you know, sort of created a cynical, you know, person. And secondly, I'm even more amazed today than I've ever been by the capabilities we offer, most of which is our human capital, really. It's the capability, the talent level, the quality of workforces we have is amazing. Where we generally lack is more in the leadership and direction and bureaucracy aspects, but the quality of people we have is my hope, to answer your question, is that we can. It's going to take, you know, real leaders emerging at all levels, not just at the high level driving cooperation, say at the national level, but young officers, young people who are demanding change. There's got to be a moment where the youth that are driving a lot of the protests and say rebelliousness against the status quo and the global system that they see is not moving an inch, and it's not really, that they're going to demand change, especially when generational changes are, now that's a long time, that's too long to wait, but I often use this example. We're going to see, already I see my own kids and grandkids, a different attitude about the world, different concerns than I had. They're the litmus test for me that my general instincts are on, of the way I felt about the world in the 60s and 70s. They're now looking at the world of the 2020s and 2030s in a totally different light.
Thank you. Yeah, that seems to be working now. Cool. Sorry about that. Had a slight problem there. What was my last question? So thank you so much for that, Rolf. We're going to wrap up, but I just wanted to ask you if there's anything else you'd like to add before we do wrap up today.
I do get some encouragement. I've had some encouragement in the last 2 years, say, that there is a different attitude emerging that's causing me to be more hopeful on action. Finally, this is maybe an issue where it was an issue before it's, that was the name of the chapter or the book in my memoir I called Before It's Time. When I described a little of this, I didn't want to get too heavy into it because I felt that's exactly what I felt when I walked away and went to the Middle East was, okay, well, people weren't ready for this politically and even in the intelligence world. At that time, I think we might be almost there. So there, you know, I'm pushing through my limited means, you know, I know that having someone like Kerry in the White House, I take as being hugely significant, because you have that one name now, right? you have at least the top end name. Now, we don't have the person yet and the second name, which, you know, in fact, I sometimes annoy people because they say, well, what do you give us your set of recommendations for WMD? Not that they would take them or, you know, but just to hear them. And I always just say, give me the three names. Then I'll, if you do those, and then it'll come back to me, I'll tell you what other stuff you need to do. Because most of what else I'd say, and this certainly applies to climate change, would be things I would want those three people to formulate. And if you've got the right people, then I would have more confidence that you've cared enough to at least put someone in charge. When I, there's a kind of very awkward chapter I call, I almost didn't write it in my book, where I talked about my last experience with WMD was in the Bush administration, 2008, when he was transferring it over to Obama. And he hadn't got to know me by this point. So we had another meeting in July or something, and he said, do these things, and they weren't done. And so at that time, Sam Bodman, who's the Secretary of Energy, was pushing me for, tell me when they're done. Tell me when they're done. I want to go to the president. If they don't do it, I'm not going to put up with this. And you know, they weren't done. So in come around October, he said, okay, I want a memo. Give me a memo. I'm going to give it to the president. So I did. I wrote a 2-page memo, basically coming up with this 3-name thing, saying, Mr. President, they didn't do what you said. And, you know, I wouldn't accept anything they said at this point unless they could at least tell you that. There was a huge uproar. I didn't really care. I knew at that point, not, I would have said it anyway if I were staying. I mean, just to be clear, but I was already aware that I was heading up to Harvard at this point. So it boils down, I'm sitting in, I won't say with whom, very senior person, one of the top 3 or 4 people in the U.S. intelligence community. And we're talking about this. He says to me, well, I'm just really upset with you for this. Why didn't you come to me? I said, well, I did. I sent you an email. I warned you. I would never blindside, you know, anybody. That's never my intention. So I said, I warned you. I didn't really think you were serious. You're going to do this. And then, you know, I said, well, you probably should take it seriously. I said, you know, and at that point he goes, well, what do you want me to do? Just tell me now what you want me to do so I can get this off my back. I said, give me your name. Who in CIA is in charge? So he turns all red. He's very upset with me. And he says, well, do you have a name? So I took a piece of paper. This was not helpful to our over. Took a piece of paper out with 3 or 4 names on it. And I handed it to him. I said, I thought you might ask me that, because I happen to know there's not a name. There's nobody in charge. So here it is. I'll make your job easy for you. So that was sort of ended the meeting on a, say, professional but quiet note. Mm. And they never did come up with the name. And you know, it's a very telling thing, you know, and I've said to people since, I think that is one of the lingering things I never learned about my business, is why is it so hard to do easy things?
Yeah.
This is not a hard problem, Chris. Yeah. This is put, you know, I'm asking you to divert precious resources, critical things that are doing incredibly important things, lots of money, lots of people. It was never the problem with WMD. I started out my career in government writ large as an Army officer, as I said, and in 4 years or whatever, I was an Army captain with about 150 people in an armored cavalry troop, we call it, which is a company size element, large company, 150 people. I'd be happy with 150 people doing WMD work. The right people, the right. I'd probably be happy. I don't know how many people we need when I say that. I'm just trying to get ballparky here. I'd be happy with 150 people dedicated, devoted to climate. I'm not happy when you tell me there's an analyst in charge in CIA and he or she does this along with their other 4 things, or a little team of 5.
Yeah.
It's not serious. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
We've always chosen the sort of deceptive response to things like this, where, you know, we do something and we say it honestly, but it's not really what we say it is. So you go to, we do this sometimes with you know, when Congress asks an uncomfortable question, how many Arabists do you have patrolling, you know, in the Middle East right now doing classic work, just so we know what's going, we can predict the next Arab Spring. They ask that question, but that's not the real question. The real question is, what kind of insight do we have into what's going on in the high levels in the Middle East? That's the question. Not how many Arabists we have. They ask that question because CIA can come back and say, we got these, and impress everybody with all these people that are in training to take Arabic. It's not the answer to the question. So it's the same thing with climate change or WMD. Those kinds of answers are typical answers we give. We give answers. We used to call them man hours. How many man hours are we doing? That would be like human hours or something. I don't know. That's not the answer to the question. It doesn't matter how many man hours we got devoted. No good corporation that puts out top products would go about measuring its effort. They measure its productivity, its results. In the end of the day, are we able to uniquely give the president a presidential daily briefing with the best information intelligence can obtain on global national security threats caused by climate change now and projecting out in the future? That's the measurement. You can picture that. You can picture the potential products. You can almost write them in your mind. So then you translate that into the capabilities you need, whether those capabilities exist today or whether you need to go out and get them. Then you can assess the cost. Then you, not just in terms of the price, but price tag, but in terms of what you can't do maybe. Because the other thing I would never let the intelligence community get away with if I were oversight would be, you know, we've got too many things to do. We can't add that to our list. That is the laziest response I've ever heard to any question, frankly. And it's typically an answer you hear.
Yeah.
And instead of fundamentally reassessing how we're going about doing our business, we say, we've said publicly, I've heard testimony, like, we can't predict events. We're not soothsayers. We're not, you know, we can't, anyone who expects us to be able to predict the future is overestimating what we're capable of doing. My reaction to that is, it depends on the reason for that. If the problem is so difficult, so complex, which I would maintain, because I'm proud enough to say this in our work, that there's no problem too complex to break down. And I mean, that's what I learned in DOE above all. You use complex modeling, you get better. You don't solve it. You don't crack it. You don't say, 3 weeks from now on this date, this is what this plane's going down or whatever. No, you can't do that. But you got to be able to predict trends in intelligence. Yeah. You got to be able to establish, which we lost in these three events. Successively, we lost our confidence that we could reestablish a semblance of traditional foresight and early warning that intelligence was founded to do. That's the essence of giving the president a decision advantage, is some appreciation of future risks and events that may occur because of those risks. Can you call the day and the event precisely? No, of course not. But you've got to be able to instill in your leaders enough awareness of problems that they're not shocked and surprised and unprepared to deal with them as they emerge, and more importantly, in the follow-up, in the response to the problem. So in the case of climate change or WMD, it means you've got the capabilities established within the government that are responding to it and that would respond if there was a crisis or an event that would challenge your entire system. That's what essence of what I've been saying throughout our interview, Chris, is that's what we need here. That's why intelligence has to be in the picture.
Yeah. Where can listeners sort of find out more about you and your work and kind of connect with you?
Well, Googling me helps. The Harvard site, Belfer Center, has still a lot of my old work and my bio listed on the Belfer Center at Harvard University. It's all up there. I'm still a senior fellow, as I said. Then you know, my memoirs. I mean, I hate to do it. I'm not peddling my memoir, but it's the best source of kind of the whole story, you know, of where I've been and what I think about. And what I tried to do in a nutshell is, well, it's more a religious book or a faith-based book than it is about. So the highest level of, say, attention in the book is my faith. And then I'd say it's philosophy. But when you get into philosophy, it touches on so many of the things we've discussed, because it gets into, say, justifying or repudiating or evaluating all the work that the intelligence part of the book is really about. And war stories to hopefully, and I wasn't going to write a memoir, but hopefully to to describe something more important than the story itself or the work. It's certainly not a here's about me book, because I wasn't going to write a celebration of myself book. And I don't think it comes across that way to anybody who reads it at all. But that was the reason why. And so when you get into some of the things in the DOE, I tell the story of what we started out our discussion today with, which is for moving from a world where it's about classical espionage and spies who save the world, like Penkovsky, or you know, which was my life and my work, and I got in the middle of moles and Aldrich Ames and Robert. I mean, I'm stuck in the middle of all that. Served in Moscow in the Cold War twice, you know. So that's all there, but that's my world until it's not.
Thank you so much for joining me today. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. This is Secrets and Spies.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.